Well, good morning, everybody. This is Jean Rowland from Quality Health Associates, and I'd like to welcome you to our antibiotic stewardship coaching call today. We have six participants on the call so far that are representing hospitals and hospital emergency departments, so we're excited to move through the agenda with that in mind. So last week when Dr. Carson spoke to a group, he defined antibiotic stewardship as assuring the right drug in the right dose for the right duration at the right time every time. But how do we get to that seems to be the big question, because there is no universal formula to accomplish this effort from healthcare setting to healthcare setting. So despite the lack of a universal formula, there is guidance. The CDC has published antibiotic stewardship core elements for outpatient settings, nursing homes, and hospitals, including a separate set for small and critical access like those on the line today. We've seen through our work with antibiotic stewardship that there's definite alignment in the guidelines and opportunities to establish programs that complement one another. So each of the participants joining us today has joined QHA's initiative to create and implement an antibiotic stewardship in their facility. Even with the guidance available, there remain questions, concerns, and even sometimes apprehension about how to go about this task. So that's where our subject panel, our expert panel, comes in today. We have the expertise, and I call it the brain trust, available today to discuss, brainstorm, and provide reinforcement to help you move forward with confidence. So I'm going to begin by introducing our expert panel. I'll start with Dr. Paul Carson. He comes from Swanford Health, Fargo, where he's an infectious diseases specialist and is an NDSU professor as well as a consultant to the North Dakota Department of Health. I think he needs very little introduction. Over the last several months, he's become our state's renowned antibiotic stewardship subject matter expert. He's delivered numerous antibiotic stewardship talks to multiple healthcare settings, sharing not only the predefined what and how, but also his practical experiences in setting up and leading a hospital antibiotic stewardship program. Brody Mack is a doctor of pharmacy, clinical pharmacist specialist at Family Health Care in Fargo, and an assistant professor at the NDSU School of Pharmacy. Brody is involved in many ambulatory care programs at Family Health Care and wears several hats as a member of their interdisciplinary care teams. He's been instrumental in their progress towards implementing a stewardship program addressing the core elements of outpatient antibiotic stewardship. Excuse me. Faye Falzer, the HAI activities coordinator from our North Dakota Department of Health, serves as a strong voice and a reliable resource for antibiotic stewardship program implementation in various healthcare settings. Her many years of diverse nursing experience, direct contact with healthcare facilities across the state, and involvement in conducting infection control assessments in many of our North Dakota hospitals and nursing homes equips her well to serve as an expert and advisor for our AS implementation. Jamie Stagg is also a director of pharmacy and serves as a quality improvement program manager at Quality Health Associates. His expertise lends crucial value to our antibiotic stewardship work locally and regionally. He's regarded as a subject matter expert in antibiotic stewardship in North Dakota as well as across the Great Plains Quinn four-state region. And Michelle Lochner is a quality improvement specialist at QHA, and she leads our nursing home task that includes an antibiotic stewardship component. She does a fantastic job of leading and mentoring our long-term care facilities and is held in very high regard by her project participants, peers, and colleagues. Much of the antibiotic stewardship work that she does with long-term care facilities filters over into the CAW arena. So first of all, thank you to the panel for joining us today. I'm certain that everyone joining us will benefit from your expertise. So by now, hopefully all of you have listened to the Strive on-demand learning modules that were the springboard for today's call. Copies of the PowerPoint presentation were sent out to everybody earlier today in the event you didn't have a chance to listen to the recordings. So today's call is considered yours. We'll move through the call module by module and invite you to ask questions, share your antibiotic stewardship experiences, and to address barriers and successes that you've run up against. We want to make sure this is a learning event for everybody who's involved. So let's begin by discussing the basics of antibiotic stewardship as highlighted in the STRIVE Introduction of Antibiotic Stewardship. In this module, STRIVE leads defined and described the need for stewardship programs. They addressed each component of hospital antibiotic stewardship as defined by the CDC, and of course this aligns with our outpatient stewardship. They address barriers and strategies to overcome anticipated barriers. And they provided valuable case studies and highlighted resources that will be of value moving forward. So regardless of the healthcare setting that you represent, leadership endorsement and commitment and expertise are crucial to the success of the antibiotic stewardship program. The mere fact that your facility joined our initiative and that you're joining our call today just tells me that you have the leadership endorsement that you need to begin your AS work. But do you have the commitment and the expertise that are necessary to build a strong and sustainable program? And do you have dedicated time and resources necessary to implement a comprehensive program? So this is where I'm going to pause and ask those who've joined us today if they have questions, comments, or experiences with the leadership, commitment, and expertise core elements that they'd like to share. All right. Well, let's review some of the recommendations for the leadership core element. First and foremost, our experts advise that we obtain a formal written statement of support from leadership, as well as some budgetary expectations associated with antibiotic stewardship. In terms of accountability, it's recommended that there be somebody from a leadership capacity, such as a chief medical officer or somebody from the C-suite, to be involved in the antibiotic stewardship program as a team member. From a commitment vantage point, there is the recommendation that a policy for creation or expansion of antibiotic stewardship programs for all core elements be approved, that integration of stewardship activities into ongoing quality improvement and or patient safety efforts is done very deliberately. Also, that there's a reporting structure for the stewardship program to ensure that information on stewardship activities and outcomes is shared with facility leadership and boards. There's the recommendation that a formal board-approved statement on the importance of antibiotic stewardship be implemented, as well as a statement from leadership highlighting to all providers and patients the commitment to improve antibiotic use in each facility. And also, there is a strong recommendation for training for stewardship leaders on antibiotic stewardship throughout online and in-person courses. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice already. It's also recommended that facilities write and display public commitments for antibiotic stewardship and include antibiotic stewardship-related duties in position descriptions or job evaluation criteria and communicate with all staff to set patient expectations. And from an expertise vantage point, there is the expectation that you will build a multidisciplinary team to complete this work in your facility, and wherever possible, that it's led by a PharmD or an infection diseases specialist, or when those persons are absent, perhaps an infection preventionist or quality improvement person with remote support from those specialties. And, of course, a multidisciplinary team should always include lab, IT, nursing services, and even environmental services. So being there were no questions related to the leadership and commitment and expertise module, I'm going to defer to our expert panel to ask them to share briefly some of their experiences with this particular core element in their facility. Dr. Carson, I think I'll begin with you.
Sure. Thank you, Jean. You know, so when looking at that leadership commitment, that's often, I think, the first big hurdle to try and overcome, because it's often perceived rightly that it's going to be a commitment of some resources and a cost. At Sanford Health, where I started an antimicrobial stewardship program quite a ways back now, so we started this in 2006, we had to go to our chief medical officer and the head of our pharmaceutical services and really kind of pitch the idea of starting an antimicrobial stewardship program with dedicated resources of a pharmacist's time. And we were looking for initially a half of an FTE for a pharmacist, which eventually became a full FTE, and then part of an infectious disease specialist time. And it was perceived as a bit of a gamble on their part, and we had to work to promote and sell that idea. But eventually they did come on board with that, and I think it was very important that we were able to show significant improvements with the start of that multidisciplinary team. So within the first year, we actually were able to show significant cost reductions in our antibiotic use, which really is not the most important issue. The most important thing is trying to reduce the number of infections with resistant bacteria and reduce the adverse effects from unnecessary or inappropriate antibiotics. We gathered data and were able to show that, and actually it was quite apparent that really right from the beginning that the resources they allocated to our antimicrobial stewardship team were more than overcome by the savings and improvement in quality and the care of the patients. And so we've had pretty wide support now for our ongoing efforts in antimicrobial stewardship. But it does require that initial commitment on leadership's part, which may sometimes be perceived as a gamble or that the benefits aren't completely clear to them. There's now a plethora of literature out there, numerous studies showing that these programs are beneficial and save costs and improve quality of care.
Thank you for sharing, Dr. Carson. You made some very good points, and I would like to reiterate to the persons who've joined us today that if you're struggling with this particular core element and need assistance in establishing a business case for implementation, please don't hesitate to reach out. We do have several resources available for just that purpose. I think now I would like to move on and ask Brody, what is your experience with this element been from a clinic perspective?
Yeah, thanks, Jean. So, yeah, my perspective is a little bit different just because I am in an outpatient clinic setting. So, you know, Family Healthcare is a federally qualified health center, so it's a community health center with a family medicine practice. You know, the buy-in has a little bit of a different feel. When I brought this program to our management team as well as our medical director, there wasn't as much emphasis that I really could put or needed to put on cost reduction, simply because, you know, in a hospital, obviously you have a lot more direct cost reduction elements, whereas in a clinic, we don't have a formulary that we manage. We don't have, you know, we're not reducing cost of medication use within our facility. Rather, we're simply trying to improve antibiotic prescribing habits and things of that nature. One unique aspect, though, that has helped get buy-in is simply, you know, looking at some of these quality measures and health measures that are sort of data-driven but often emphasized in outpatient settings. And so being a federally qualified health center, we have a couple different types of quality measures or organizations that oversee quality measures that we are encouraged to essentially adhere to. And there are some antibiotic-associated quality measures that our clinic tracks already. And so that's kind of where, you know, where my focus was to talk to management about how can we improve the quality measures that we do track, how can we expand some of these measures and look at other types of infections and types of prescribing habits within antibiotic use. And you know, with our medical director and our medical staff, everybody bought in simply because they recognize the importance of antimicrobial stewardship. And, you know, I think they practice and see enough patients that are in and out of the hospital to recognize how important it is and the impact that they can have on the outpatient side. So lucky for me, management and medical staff both bought in pretty readily. Obviously, as the clinical pharmacist, I'm sort of responsible as the lead on the project, but I right away identified one or two people from the medical staff to sort of be the provider champions, if you will. And so our medical director, as well as one of our nurse practitioners, have sort of bought on to that champion role. And so my plan for the future is to make sure to involve them, you know, in any meetings, and eventually I'd like to establish an antimicrobial stewardship committee, much similar to what hospitals do, to kind of proceed with that role. And then that kind of sort of takes the commitment, which wasn't so hard for me, right into the accountability and getting some of these provider champions, and then get nursing staff involved and hold them accountable for some duties and things to promote the project.
So in the process of doing all this, did the team actually go through the process of revising job descriptions and seeing to it that responsibilities were directed toward individuals in the clinic?
That's a good question. We have not gotten to that point yet. So our process is pretty much still in its infancy, although we've done a few things that have gotten us quite a ways with stewardship. We haven't quite gotten to the point where, you know, we've modified job descriptions and we've established an actual committee to do the work and things like that. A lot of it has been, you know, we have twice a month provider meetings that we discuss a variety of topics. And so it's really been discussed in smaller chunks in those meetings to this point. And we've had a couple outside antibiotic-focused meetings besides. But, you know, that's kind of the next step, is looking at, you know, how do we establish a committee? How do we establish, you know, job description changes and identify, you know, essentially titles and roles within the antimicrobial stewardship process?
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing. Faye, in the work that you've done with our hospitals and nursing homes around the state, have you seen or heard anything from the hospitals or from your contacts regarding struggles with this core element?
I think initially the bigger struggle was getting the buy-in from the nursing staff, having them see it as a key role for them to be aware of antibiotic ordering and what's appropriate, what's not, learning about the colonization versus infection, and then also finding that combination with the pharmacy to help be the team lead for the antibiotic stewardship. And I know a lot of smaller facilities struggle with the pharmacy component. There are some working on expanding their contract to provide that service. So I guess I'd like to hear from facilities what they feel the struggles are for them, and see if we can help them, give them some pointers on what they're struggling with for this component.
Yeah, I agree. And so since we started the call, John has told me that we've got over 15 participants on the line now, so he did mute the lines. However, piggybacking on Faye's request, we would like to hear from you. We would like to hear about your struggles with this particular core element. To share with us, please press star 6 on your keypad, and it should unmute your line. We'll give you a couple minutes to do that.
Jean, this is Jamie.
Hi, Jamie.
One thing I'd like to ask the group too is, you know, we definitely want to hear where they're having some struggles, but I'd also like to hear if you're seeing success with this. And Brody gave some great examples there. And if anyone else has success stories they'd like to share on this, I'd welcome those too.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Has anybody unmuted their line, and are you ready to talk? All right. Well, Michelle, would you be willing to just share with us briefly some of the struggles that you hear from the nursing home community regarding this? Because I'm certain that they are similar struggles or even, you know, share successes as well that you've seen that might help people overcome their struggles with leadership endorsement and support.
Sure. thanks, Jean. I'd like to just echo what Faye has been saying. That's, you know, really a lot of the starting point is getting the nursing staff on board. We have a lot of entrenched ideas about the rationale behind starting antibiotics, and that's really deep within our nursing culture, and then has also been educated to the residents and family members of our nursing home residents. So I don't know that it's necessarily so difficult to get the buy-in in support of leadership if you've got your nursing staff supporting and promoting it. And that's a struggle that a lot of facilities are working on, that it just takes a lot of continued effort on it, and it seems to be a lot of repeated effort. But, you know, as long as we keep all striving towards the same goal, I think we will get there.
Very good. Thanks for sharing. Okay, to our participants, this will be the last call for sharing for this particular core element. All right, well, I think we'll go ahead and we'll move on to action. So the core element of action involves implementing evidence-based interventions that can improve antibiotic use and promote antibiotic prescribing practices. This is very, very facility-specific. So before we move in to reviewing the recommendations and such, I would just like to ask our audience again, do you have questions, comments, or experiences that you would like to share regarding the action core element? Okay. Some recommendations for implementing the action core element in facilities from our experts are to, very broadly, from a broad perspective, put in place a formal procedure for all clinicians to review the appropriateness of all antibiotics 48 hours after initial orders or an antibiotic timeout. To implement a process for antibiotic agents to be approved by a physician or a pharmacist prior to dispensing. To implement a physician or pharmacist review of therapy for specified antibiotic agents with feedback, or otherwise a prospective audit. Drilling down a little bit further and looking at this, recommendations for pharmacy include review antibiotics for unnecessary duplicative antibiotic therapy, such as a double anaerobic or a double anti-MRSA coverage. Also to review for opportunities for IV or oral conversion, or monitor for medication safety through these general pharmacy practices and practices that are not necessarily specific to antibiotic stewardship. From a nursing perspective, you can put in processes in place to review culture techniques to ensure that microbiology cultures are collected properly, to be sure that the culture results guide the treatment that is available. Also put in processes to monitor response to antibiotic therapy with feedback to the treating clinician and pharmacist, and assess oral intake and clinical status to alert providers and pharmacists when there are opportunities to convert antibiotics from IV to oral. And of course, an ever-important role for nurses is patient education. So educate patients about potential adverse effects associated with antibiotics, especially around C. difficile infections. And it's also recommended that nurses are well-positioned to initiate antibiotic timeouts with the treating clinician and pharmacist and to review antibiotic therapy after 24 hours or 48 hours of treatment. I'm sorry. If we were to get a little bit more specific on this and look more at the clinic setting, some of the recommendations that you would see would include to use evidence-based diagnostic criteria and treatment recommendations. Most of these align with the inpatient measures that we've talked about. Use delayed prescribing practices or watchful waiting when appropriate. Provide communication skills training for clinicians. Sometimes it's very difficult to have these conversations with patients when they're coming to the clinic expecting to have an antibiotic to help them get over whatever is ailing them. To require explicit written justification in the medical record for non-recommended antibiotic prescribing, to provide support for clinical decisions, and to use call centers, nurse hotlines, or physician consultations as triage systems to prevent unnecessary visits. So I'll make one more call for feedback, comments, or sharing related to the core element of action. All right, well, I think we'll go back to our round robin, and I'll just ask each of our panelists to please share with us your successes and experiences with this particular element in your facility. I'll begin again with Dr. Carson.
Okay. You did. That was a very nice outline of a number of different options for places to potentially act or intervene with an antimicrobial stewardship team or program. And I would just encourage the listeners to know that you don't have to do all of those. In fact, you don't have to do most of those. As Jean said earlier, this is facility-specific, and you kind of look at your own facility, your own circumstances, your own setting, and try and decide, you know, which is a priority for you and target that. In our own experience, prior to our formal initiation of our antimicrobial stewardship team, we had done a lot of the things that have been looked at by a number of facilities in the past. So those are things like formulary restrictions and prior authorization. So, for example, for the very broad-spectrum antibiotics or for very costly antibiotics or for antibiotics that we really want to preserve and limit their use, we would require providers to call an infectious disease physician. Now, a lot of facilities won't have an infectious disease physician available to them, but it actually might be something you could consider talking to your regional centers where there is an infectious disease physician, possibly even contract for that service to help with prior authorization for the more big gun, if you will, antibiotics. We'd also been involved with putting out guidelines and clinical pathways. I think those are good, but I'm not a huge fan of those making a big difference in an institution because they're only as good as how often people, you know, pull them up and use them. And we often find that we put those in our online resources or electronic medical record and may or may not get used very frequently depending on how well they're promoted. We've been doing the IV to oral conversion program for some time, so there are a number of different antibiotics that are extremely bioavailable, and so they're pretty much as good oral as they are IV. I don't consider that a true stewardship program other than for the cost savings that it brings, but that's sometimes a low-hanging fruit that you can take to administration to show as an early, easily achievable success for cost savings with your program that can then help to have the resources available for your team to be able to do, I think, other, perhaps more meaningful work. I think it's always a great service to have the pharmacist doing review for dose optimization, particularly for those kinds of drugs that require therapeutic drug monitoring, like vancomycin, aminoglycosides, et cetera. Those are all things that we had done in the past. I think all things that are very useful. A lot of institutions do that. I think that's sort of the next layer up from that is giving provider and staff education. So we would do seminars and educational events, but those two I think are limited because they tend to have a short-lived institutional memory and staff turns over and things change and you have to kind of keep at that. I think that the things that Gene talked about also in the list about audit and feedback are really where the, kind of the money is, if you will, or where the best sort of best cost effectiveness for your team is at. So that's trying to pick some measure that you want to improve. So, for example, on the outpatient side of things, you know, how often antibiotics are given for acute bronchitis, where they're really almost never indicated, or how often antibiotics are given for acute sinusitis before you meet guidelines, which is usually 10 days of symptoms or severe symptoms present, or how often antibiotics are given for pharyngitis, for example, when there's no laboratory test done that was confirming group A strep. Those are potential outpatient measures, you know, where you could do some kind of auditing, chart tracking, surveillance, and getting a measure of how often appropriate use of antibiotics were done. We do that on the inpatient side of things. So when we started our antibiotic stewardship team in 2007, we had a pharmacist and an infectious disease physician review. After building a tool within our electronic medical record, we had these individuals review almost everyone who was on an antibiotic in our institution on a daily basis during the weekdays, Monday through Friday. And then we gave immediate feedback to providers on that use and making sort of friendly suggestions, if you will. And that was tremendously successful at improving our antibiotic use. We're now moving in the direction of trying to track individual provider level antibiotic prescribing patterns and habits to give them comparative data on how they use antibiotics and look compared to their peers. That's a little bit more uncomfortable, but it can be a very, very powerful tool in improving use, and we've seen that in our hospital. We've also just started to develop appropriate guidelines for the use of certain antibiotics, for example, our carbapenems and our quinolones, and we've made forced indications for those within the electronic medical record. So if you want to give that drug, you have to check one of the checkboxes that is a recognized or approved indication for that drug. If you're giving it for something other than one of those approved or recognized reasons, you have to free text in why you're giving it, and then, of course, that's gonna generate a look from the antimicrobial stewardship team. That measure alone, by putting in these appropriate recognized indications that our antibiotic stewardship committee developed, has had an immediate significant impact on the overall use of some of these targeted antibiotics. So those are some of the things that we've done over time. We're now moving our attention into the outpatient or ambulatory arena and trying to get a handle on how we want to try and drive appropriate antibiotic use in the much larger setting of antibiotic use, which is the ambulatory world. So on the hospital side, we've been at it for a while with this prospective audit and feedback and formulary restriction and prior authorization, but now we're trying to figure out how to get our arms around the outpatient world.
You're correct. It is a much broader audience to reach in a different approach is certainly warranted to do that. Brody, maybe Dr. Carson can glean some expertise from you in your experience in doing this in your clinic.
Yeah, those are really good points, Dr. Carson, and I think it's interesting because when you talked about how you went about the action and the inpatient side, the way that we're going about our sort of action core element in the outpatient side is almost the opposite. We're actually starting, or I've sort of decided that, you know, maybe we should start with some communication skills training for clinicians, basically because I'm not involved like an inpatient pharmacist is. And I think, you know, like I said, I think it's a much more closed system. So, you know, pharmacies more directly involved with some of the decision making, and clinicians, you know, can easily report on which antibiotics they're using and in almost real time. Versus in the outpatient setting, our providers in general feel confident on their education level and their knowledge base on how to prescribe antibiotics and when, as well as which antibiotics to choose. And that, you know, just in talking with our providers, that was never the initial issue on from their perspective. And so what I did is I kind of went at it as, you know, one of the check boxes under the action element for the outpatient setting is provide communication skills training for clinicians. And basically what I did is I kind of used that webinar that, and I forget the title of it, but it was a few months ago, that discussed communication skills trainings for clinicians in a clinic setting. And I had all of our providers together in a meeting. We viewed the webinar and then just kind of had a discussion after that to kind of gauge where my providers were at as far as their comfort level with some of those communication skills. What were they doing already? What might they change after viewing that? And then just have a discussion in general about antibiotic stewardship on how they felt they were doing and where they felt we should go from there. And again, that kind of came out of that is I, you know, my initial thought was I need to go in and I need to educate providers about what are the current guidelines for community-acquired pneumonia and what antibiotics should be used and what's the dosing and kind of typical pharmacy, you know, thinking. But really, that's not what they want. They feel confident in their knowledge base. They want sort of more outside the box. How can we convince our patients they don't need an antibiotic? How can we be sure that we're not prescribing antibiotics? We need to check on that. So that gets into some of the tracking and reporting. You know, the other thing that I sort of want to take to, for the next step is, you know, in the inpatient setting, most hospitals have at their disposal their local resistance patterns and their antibiograms, whereas in clinics, that's not general practice. You know, sometimes providers have the luxury of having hospital privileges, and maybe they kind of look at those antibiograms from time to time, but I would like to use that as a clinical decision support tool, you know, for example, to reduce quinolone usage in community-acquired pneumonia in the outpatient setting. You know, if we're seeing resistance patterns showing us that we need to limit our quinolone use, well, let's train and educate our providers on that and give them that tool, you know, by working with some of our local health systems here in town. So that's kind of the approach that I've taken so far. The next step will be looking into how can we get nursing involved into this action component. You know, how can we have more of a little bit of a higher level triage system? You know, one of the last checkboxes is using a call center or a nurse hotline as a triage system. When patients call in and talk about their symptoms, how many of those patients really need to come to the clinic and how many can wait a day or two before calling back to see if things have just gotten better on their own? So that's kind of where we're at. And obviously, like I said before, it's still in its infancy, but I thought it was interesting that my approach is almost the opposite of yours, Dr. Carson, with the outpatient side of things.
You know, if I can just follow up on that, thank you, Rory. That's a really good point. And to that point, as we started to get into the outpatient world, we heard exactly what you heard in your clinic setting, that most of the providers get this, they understand it, they know the right thing to do, but they're facing, you know, patient demand that within a very short period of time for the visit, and they know that they'll get poor patient satisfaction scores if they don't give that expected antibiotic, or that they're likely to go down the street to somebody else where they're going to get it. And we heard that feedback a lot from a lot of different settings, and I've heard that certainly when I've gone out to educate on antibiotic stewardship. And just to that point, I'd like to tout a couple things that have been done recently. With the recent National Antibiotic Awareness Week, myself working with the North Dakota Health Department and the QIN tried to reach out to the patient population with some articles on that went out in newsletters from some of the major health plans in North Dakota, talking about, you know, why and when not to ask your doctor for antibiotics or to listen to them when they say you don't need those. And then we also sent out a number of links to tools for providers, particularly in the outpatient setting, on patient education sheets, some really excellent ones that are now from a partnership with the American Board of Internal Medicine and Consumer Reports under the Choosing Wisely campaign, some very, very good resources for patients on why you need to use antibiotics more judiciously, listen to your doctor, et cetera, and some tools for kind of viral prescription pads, if you will. If you've got a viral illness, a lot of times patients just want to have something in hand when they leave the office, and to have this sort of instructions on how to manage your viral infection and some over-the-counter, quotes, prescriptions, if you will, what to go get from the pharmacy to help you through those symptoms, often is a satisfier for patients. So that went out to the North Dakota Academy of Family Physicians and went out to the North Dakota American College of Physicians and the American Pediatric Association North Dakota chapter. So we're hoping that those tools to help providers manage that expectations of their patients will help them to do that better.
You know, you make a good point, and I think that the over-the-counter prescription, so to say, recommendations are very important. I think two things about that. A patient leaving with a clinic with something in hand is very, very important. They came there for something, and they want to leave with something. But I also think that there are so many over-the-counter medications that are available that sometimes it's hard for the patient to even select what would work best for their condition. So that's a fantastic recommendation. John just stepped into my office, another staff member just stepped into my office and said that some are having difficulty unmuting their lines. So, John, let's give the audience a chance to respond. Will you unmute all the lines for us, please?
Absolutely.
All right, so everybody is unmuted. Now's the time to share your feedback on any of these particular elements so far.
So, Jean, this is Doris Vegan from Mayville, and I was the person.
Fantastic.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes.
Okay. And I'm here with our pharmacist, and I just wanted to say the last items that you were talking about, we had presented several different things, like from the CDC website about, you know, this is just bronchitis and what's viral and all that. But the ones that our providers liked the most were the one that came from the QIN that looks like the prescription blank that gives other, you know, these are the resources that you should use for this viral condition. So we have those down in all our offices and then also in the ER here in Mayville.
Well, it's great to hear. And so for others who are on the line, if you're interested in tracking down that particular tool, you can contact me. I'll send you the direct link. Or you can go to our Great Plains QIN, that's GreatPlainsQIN.org, I believe, website, and locate the tool and look through the various resources that are available there as well.
And then we just had one other question, and this is because we have been mostly focusing on UTIs over this quarter with our providers. You know, when a culture comes back, mixed microflora, so there's obviously no sensitivity, and that's after they're probably in their antibiotic for a few days. What's the right course then?
Dr. Carson, I'll ask you to take that question.
Sure. That's a really common scenario and a really, I find personally, a very frustrating one. So what that means, when you get a urine culture back, technically what that means is that it's a negative culture. You do not have enough organisms there with a predominant pathogen to suggest that that's a positive culture. It means it's typically less than 100,000 colonies, often less than 10,000 colonies, of more than typically two or more organisms, and that suggests a contaminated specimen. That it's, if it's in a female, it usually means vaginal contamination. So technically, that's a negative culture. Now, I'll tell you that I've seen many patients over the years where I think symptomatically they have a true UTI, and you'll get that report back, and you wonder, gee, if we would have had the lab parse all of those isolates out, would something sort of stand out? I think you have to use a little bit of clinical judgment there. If it's questionable symptoms, if it's very, questionable, true UTI-like symptoms, and you get that report back, I think you should strongly consider stopping therapy that you don't have a true UTI. if you've got somebody who's got very definitive dysuria, frequency, urgency, true UTI type symptoms, and you've got that kind of a culture report, I think it's possible that there may have been hidden in that sort of mixed microflora a true pathogen, but you're not going to be able to tell that. Now they're on the antibiotics. So I think based on the patient's symptoms, you should either decide to just stop therapy, that this is questionable symptoms and a negative, essentially a negative culture, or I've got really true symptoms. I don't know what the pathogen is for whatever reason on my culture results, and finish your empiric course of therapy, which for uncomplicated UTI is usually 3 days of TMP sulfa or 5 days of nitrofurantoin would be the kind of first two first-line choices for UTI. Hopefully that answers your question, but that's a frequent, challenging clinical scenario.
Thanks. That does help.
Are there other others who would like to share? All right. Well, we've had such good dialogue around action, but I think in view of time, we need to go ahead and move on to tracking and reporting, or tracking and monitoring. So tracking, monitoring, reporting is essential for informing and assessing stewardship action. This audit and feedback type of process can guide changes in practice and be used to assess program or progress in improving our antibiotic prescribing. So our conversations internally, this tends to be the area where we've received the most questions, particularly from our outpatient providers, and we do have several on the phone at this point. So what I would like to do is just share those questions that we've received. They're very generic, actually. It's where do we start? What do we track, and how do we go about tracking it? And so I think what I would like to do is start with Brody and just ask you, Brody, where did you start in your organization in your tracking and reporting process? Can you elaborate on that a little bit more?
Yeah, absolutely, Jean. I think that's a really good question because that's kind of what I had the same question when I was looking into, you know, sort of signing on to this initiative. It was kind of like, well, where do I start? And, you know, especially tracking and reporting is overwhelming for, I think, pretty much everybody. So, you know, the one thing about outpatient settings that's a little bit different than inpatient settings is that I think nowadays most, if not all, clinics probably track some information or data related to those quality measures that I was talking about, that I kind of touched on a little bit earlier. And so the first thing I did is just look through our current quality measures and to kind of see, are we tracking anything right now related to antibiotics at all? And if so, let's just look at that first, and that's a start. And luckily for me, we have two sort of steps of quality measures. One is reporting to the federal government through something called the UDS in federally qualified health centers. The other is through our patient-centered medical home program on some of the meaningful use and quality measures we do there. And one of our measures is looking at upper respiratory infections and the rate at which our providers are prescribing antibiotics. And I noticed that we were already tracking that, but we weren't tracking it actively. It's something we were tracking in the past. And so I went to our sort of data person, our QI individual, and just talked to her and said, hey, you know, can you just give me the information about how we tracked this and why did we stop tracking it? And lo and behold, you know, we stopped tracking it because our providers were doing such a wonderful job and the percentage of antibiotics prescribed was quite low. And so my next question was, you know, how are we tracking that? What were the data that were pulled? What's in the denominator? What's in the numerator? And are we sure that that was a true report? And if so, great. If not, let's change it and look again and just start tracking that again. And so, you know, the good thing was they were already doing something. It didn't take a lot of work to look at it again and just kind of see was it set up correctly. And then the next step is how can we apply that same data extraction method on something else? So now let's look at UTIs or let's look at community-acquired pneumonia and look at, you know, setting up similar reports that they already know how to do and just kind of extrapolate that to other conditions or other topic areas. And that seemed to go pretty smoothly. And, you know, it's always interesting when you're looking at how data is pulled, there's always flaws. And that's, I think, where the real work comes in, is how do we improve this data extraction and make it more accurate? And then again, how, once we get that data, how do we take that back to our providers and have a discussion about how things are really going and what can we do to improve that? And I think one of the things Dr. Carson mentioned earlier is definitely applied at our setting, where a lot of these quality measures are reported as a facility, but we also report quality measures provider-specific so they can compare themselves to their colleagues in the clinic and sort of see how they're doing. And that's something that we're looking to do with stewardship-type measures as well.
Excellent. I think that having a multidisciplinary team in place to review the results of the data that's collected is very important and really helps interpret that data as well. So another thing that we hear is, you know, people become overzealous when they start collecting data. They want to know how everything looks, and they collect for various medical diagnosis and various antibiotics, and they really wind up with an enormous amount of data that they don't know what to do with. Dr. Carson, would you talk or address briefly how to narrow down your focus in data collection, especially early on as you're beginning your antibiotic stewardship initiative?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So I think I would mention that, first of all, it may be useful to the listeners to grab a hold of the CDC's resources for antimicrobial stewardship in the outpatient setting and the CDC's guidance for antimicrobial stewardship in small critical access hospitals or smaller community hospitals. And in both of those, they give kind of a list or a table of various things you could consider for your institution. And the recommendations on most of these is don't do everything. Try and pick maybe one thing. And then, you know, from that list, talking to sort of key stakeholders in your organization, where do you think we have a problem? Where do you think we could improve? You know, what are our issues? And you'll hear back. And you often know whether it's overuse of broad-spectrum agents or whether it's using antibiotics where there's very questionable infection present in the first place, like with asymptomatic bacteriuria or viral upper respiratory tract infections, or not taking that antibiotic timeout when culture data comes back to change or narrow therapy or drop certain drugs. So you know, take a look at those lists of suggestions from those CDC core element resources for the various healthcare settings. They have one for long-term care, for acute care, for outpatient care, and for small community and critical access hospitals. There are very good suggestions on practical measures that you can track or trace. And then ask those stakeholders, you know, your nurse managers, your providers, your chief medical officer, your medical directors, you know, where do we think we have an opportunity to improve? And then tackle one of those. I think the issue comes up is who's going to do that tracking and surveillance? You know, most smaller facilities already have everybody wearing, you know, 5, 6, 7 different hats. And I don't think it's, you know, fair to just say, well, add this on to your resources. But like Brody said, if you're already doing some work in a particular area, you're already surveying charts for, you know, some other related reason, this may be a way to kind of dovetail on to efforts that are already being done so you're not having to make a lot of additional work.
Thank you, and certainly there are a lot of initiatives out there that are addressing HAI reduction that can be piggybacked onto. Well, we're down to 5 minutes left in the call, so I would just like to take that last few minutes to go ahead and look at education and expertise. This particular core element assures that your program provides education to clinicians and frontline staff on antibiotic prescribing, as well as to patients and their families. Patients and families need a lot of education. This is new to them, and I just can't overemphasize the importance of having a very sound patient and family education component to your antibiotic stewardship program. So I will start with Dr. Carson again and just ask you, how have you built education and expertise into your program? You've referenced it throughout your comments, but was there a deliberate effort to see to it that certain staff members, certain clinicians were focused? Was there a deliberate effort to see to it that patients were educated well up front?
I'll answer the latter part of your question first because it's the easiest. We've come very late to the patient education part of things. You know, we were pretty good about educating staff, educating ourselves on our team, but now as part of these core elements, education includes educating our patients in these various settings. So we're now just really kind of getting into that by developing our own patient resources or borrowing from the ones that are out there, making those available to our providers to give to patients. We've been looking at ways of communicating through the electronic medical record with antimicrobial stewardship educational pieces to our patients. So that we've come to kind of late. On the drug expertise side of things, you know, I'm in a large health system, and we're fortunate to have actually a relatively deep bench of infectious disease providers and pharmacists that are, have dedicated time to do this. That's not going to be the case for the majority of our listeners and institutions out there. So I understand that that's going to be a particular challenge. But I'll just say on our own front, I'm the one who's responsible for oversight of our antimicrobial stewardship program, so I think having someone who's accountable and responsible for the success of the program is very important, and that doesn't necessarily have to be an infectious disease doctor. That can be a primary care provider who has an interest in this area and is willing to get a little more education and training on it. And there's a lot of very good educational programs out there from the Society for Healthcare Epidemiology of America through some of the pharmacist groups, MAD-ID, Making a Difference in Infectious Disease, MAD-ID, they put on antimicrobial stewardship training. SIDP, the Society for Infectious Disease Pharmacists, has an online training program. And I would encourage institutions to have their administration leadership look at making someone accountable in your organization and giving them the time and resources to go get some of this training, whether that's going to a national meeting or doing the online certification that's there for particularly aimed at pharmacists to gather that drug expertise for your institution and have an identified individual who's accountable for what metrics you're going to follow and track and how you're going to report back and how you're going to measure success.
And certainly one of the recommendations that I've read over and over again is that when providing education for healthcare professionals, be sure to try and attach CEs to it as well. Brody, would you like to share briefly some of the work that's going on in your organization around patient education? I know that in a clinic, the patient education focus is probably a little different.
Yeah, so the patient education component is something that we're actually looking at right now. And, you know, I think with our clinic providers, and probably the same goes for emergency rooms and things, you know, I think all of our electronic records are capable of printing out some generic information sheet for, you know, you have viral, upper respiratory tract infection or something like that, or you have a cold. Those things are okay. And unfortunately, sometimes tied to some of our measures that we actually do, and that satisfies those measures if we print those out and hand them to the patient. So our current push is to actually make that more effective. And so, you know, it was interesting to hear some of the things you guys are actually talking about today with the prescription pads for some of those over-the-counter medications and some of the more effective tools that can be used in place of those things to actually give to patients is kind of one of the things that we're looking at right now. And then, you know, just to, reflect back on, you know, the education component, I think is one of the easiest things in the outpatient setting to sort of implement, simply because most outpatient clinics will have you know, a provider meeting once or twice a month or some sort of set meetings throughout the year that, you know, you can easily get on the agenda, even if it's for 5 or 10 minutes, to start talking about some of these topics. And what spawns from that are, in my case, what's happened is what spawns from that is identifying that champion. And we have one of our nurse practitioners that's sort of taken an interest, and she has a high interest in infectious disease and just wants to be involved. And I wouldn't have known that unless I just sort of talked to them about it at their regular provider meetings. And so now we are able to schedule a little bit more formal, you know, stewardship discussions, which I'm hoping will form into a more formal committee with nursing and QI and everybody, to really kind of up the ante on education for our providers, as well as how can we implement more effective education for our patients.
Amazing. Thank you for sharing. Well, with that, folks, we are at the top of the hour, and I need to thank everybody for joining us. I would like to just reinforce that in terms of education especially, there is an abundance of resources available on the Great Plains Quinn website. And when it comes to staff education, the Great Plains Quinn moving forward is looking at providing some opportunities specifically for healthcare professionals around antibiotic stewardship. Keep your ear to the ground for that. We have coming in December a status checklist for our participating facilities to use. It's actually an electronic database where you can track your progress in antibiotic stewardship, and then we in turn can access it. It's web-based, so we can access it without sending reminders and whatnot, and document for our federal leads on this exactly how far we've come with antibiotic stewardship in our state. Also watch for the next, the second edition of the Antibiotic Stewardship News and Updates that QHA is publishing. I expect to have that sent out the door early next week. And to everybody, please, moving forward, share your successes, share your progress with us. It's only through your feedback that we know specifically what's going on in our state and that we can gauge where we need to go with our efforts as an organization here. So thank you again to our expert panel, and if you all would please stay on the line when we hang up here, and thank you to those who joined us today. Watch your email for a program evaluation. Thank you so much.